Give you a little background. In the 1950s, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. Worked seriously at the task. I was in a small, sleepy university down in Louisiana, and two professors came my way, one from Harvard and one from Yale, both due to heart attacks. One worked with the McCarthy Senate Commission dealing with communists and subversives in U.S. military and atomic energy and elsewhere in society. He was the lawyer, lead lawyer for the Senate and all related to those studies. Another was a part of the Truman Shadow cabinet at the end of World War II. And during major wars, the U.S. has a regular cabinet and a shadow cabinet that behind them works on the interrelated matters between the war and the other cabinet duties that are non-war duties and all. And these two men had a heart attack, so ended up at my university. I was intending to go to law school. At the time, was interested in going to LSU, which is the state, and my dad graduated from there back in the 1920s in a master's degree in agriculture, so I just assumed family-wise I'd go there. However, these men said if I'd give them all of my free time, Saturdays, weekends that I had, that they would do two things. They knew I wanted to be an international research lawyer. They knew I had a dream of going to Harvard Law School if I could, but figured that financially was out of question. And they said, we'll help you do both. I was going to go and major in international research law at Harvard, and I was going to be an international research lawyer with specialty in Sharia law so that I could help Americans that got in trouble in Islamic settings. And so they said, with the next 4 years of the university, you'll go into Harvard. We'll get you in there. Don't worry. Your entrance, of course, they didn't have all the tests like you have today. So it was more on who you knew back in the 50s and not all of these graduate entrance tests and GED qualifications and all. They hardly existed in the 50s. And they said, we'll get you into Harvard. The guy from Yale said, I'll have to swallow a few times every time I think the thought, but we'll help you get into Harvard. And they did help me get enrolled there after the university. And for 4 years, they did all they could do in teaching me to be an international research lawyer and in taking the courses I needed for that background. That's how I got into research. My interest was changed when I was asked to go to Hawaii in 1960 after the university. Before going into Harvard, was enrolled, paid my dues, had my books, and they asked would I go because Hawaii became a state then, and all foreign missionaries had to be gone by July the 4th and repositioned somewhere in the world, preferably with the Foreign Mission Board in another country, and about half of them went to other countries, about half of them took roles in the USA and elsewhere with NAM or with state conventions or seminaries or other than that. And so while I was there, they asked me to go and pastor University Baptist Church, help them get a pastor, and help a number of other churches get pastor, and then after that, come back to the States and enroll in Harvard. The only problem was, which is a wonderful, wonderful eventuality, the Lord called me into missions. So I never matriculated at Harvard. I had what I had learned from these professors and others. But in the process, I had began to study in international research law and use as a project of mine with these professors that they made me get. I was very interested in the immigration issue and how the church grew in America from 1700s to the 1950s. And of course, it was the 1950s when I was doing this study. And so I began a journey of collecting everything I could collect. Even after my first term in the Philippines from 1964 to 1969, came back, worked for the board in the journeyman program, and that gave me a chance to start in Massachusetts. I worked my way from Massachusetts to the Mississippi River, looking at all the major denominations in their archives, studying how did Congregationalists, how did Presbyterians, how did Lutheran, how did Baptists, how did Methodists, how did Anglican that became Episcopal, how did these major denominations move to the Mississippi, and I continued that study. I have continued it till today. I have a huge file of research that I collect in all times. Nahum knew about this and knew my interest in this, my study in this. They asked me in 2006 to come to the annual leadership summit of Nahum that was at Ridgecrest and present what ended up being part one of a presentation on what happened immigration-wise from 1780 to the present. And so I did what they asked. And they were wanting to then discuss the implications of that. After I did it, they said, would you come back next year, which was last year in 2007, to the summit, which I did, and would you look at the implications of what this immigration history has for church planting in the United States. So I came back and presented that last year. What you're going to see is a heavily adapted, truncated, slash and burn edition of this. Obviously, 2 years of a couple of hours each year presentation there would end up in far more screens than we could even hope to look at. And folks get frustrated when I don't truncate it and they see me going by 20 screens to get to my next one. You're going to get the full screen, both versions put together. You'll get that electronically. You'll also get the truncated one that I'm using here. And so we want to look at, again, like we did last period, we want to look at what do we know and what have we seen findings in the research over immigration in the U.S. from 1700s until 2006. What do we know? What are the findings? What happened historically? So that's what we're going to do. We're not going to have any dialogue period here. This is to put the information down on the table. We'll take another break. We'll come back. And in session three, we'll put doing the math together with your realizations there with this history. And we're going to spend the whole hour dialoguing about what you see as the hope of church planting, the style of church planting, in light of what we've seen in these modules, if we have any hope of getting at lostness in America. So we're hoping your contributions in the third hour is going to be major and are going to be major in terms of looking at this. In the fourth hour, we're going to come back and look at another overarching issue that's critical, and that will be in the field of worldview and dealing with worldview differences among all the ethnics that have come here and what are some of the issues there for church planting. And so that's where we're going this morning. And so an old proverb says, those who do not consider and pay attention to history are doomed to repeat it. And we're proving that's true over the last 50 years in evangelical and Southern Baptist life. And so we're going to look at three periods here in this module. The first of the three periods occurred between 1775 and 1924. We will extend this date to 1950 to include the religious data perimeter so that we can look at this from secular history. Then we're going to look at it from religious history, all in this module there. And we're going to extend it from 1780 to 1950. The reason 24 date is there, the U.S. saw the huge volume of immigrants coming in the USA, and in 1924 enacted a huge and very strict immigration policy that began to do what it was designed to do, and that was curtail immigration coming to the USA, which was rearranged and revoted in the 1950s, which is the current immigration policy that the politicians and others are screaming and arguing over right now. But we won't get into the political side, or we'll do our best to stay out of the political side. The second period of change occurred between 1945 and 1960. This is what I call, and there is little argument for that today. I don't get pushed back by any sociologist or anthropologist or social historians on this. It's the golden age of Christianity in America. It was a wonderful era, but it plagues us today because we have a fallacious dream that America exists like it did then, and it doesn't. And if we can't get divorced from that reality, we're going to be doomed in the church growth, church planting field. The third period of change occurred between 1960 and 2006 and will likely continue to the extreme. Many Christians are unaware of these issues. In fact, our assumptions, even now in this political year, are totally other than what's in the data. America will increasingly become ethnic. Anglos will increasingly be less of a percentage of the total population, and it will not be many decades before Anglo presence in America will be a moot issue and will be irrelevant. Ethnicity will rule America in the next 15 to 20 years rather completely, unless something cataclysmic happened, and then there won't be Anglos around to talk about it or to say anything about it. And so this is where we're faced and what we face here at this point. We're looking 1775 to 50, the main historical, social, religious factors related to immigration to the USA. Will Herberg and Oscar Hanlon's basic research findings. Oscar Hanlon said in the 1950s, once I thought to write a history of the immigrants in America, then I discovered that the immigrants were American history. Anybody that was not an immigrant was an American Indian, and we're going to look at some of the data related to them in this, and therefore 80-90% of America ended up being immigrants. And the American Indian population continued to dwindle from 1780 until the present. And so these are things. Oscar Hanlon, we'll make another note or two about him. Oscar Hanlon and Will Herberg were two of the major social historians of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Will Herberg wrote the most important sociological study of immigrants really up to this date. It's not been replaced in its importance to mark the history. The name of his social history was Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. We'll talk about why he chose that title. Oscar Hanlon wrote the classic historical novel based on actual history. He just changed a lot of names, wrote it as a novel, as a narrative, rather than a historical front piece there. He won the Pulitzer Prize for this in the 1970s. He became Harvard's chair, editor of the Harvard Encyclopedia of Ethnology and Ethnics. It, for years, was the most respected ethnic piece. Now the Ethnologue of SIL has become the most used piece of ethnology in America and in the world. But Oscar Hanlon was a famous figure in American ethnic research, even well after he wrote his Pulitzer Prize winning. I have taken both of these men's works. Their footnotes are profuse. I have gone to every, with the help of librarians, in an organization that has in Richmond two whole library staffs, one out at the Learning Center, one downtown, and they are in global research, and I've used them through the years. I have looked up every quote in Hanlon and in Herberg, followed those books, read every bit of the material they quoted to be sure they were on target, and have even followed those quotes to sub-quotes in their world there. So this is what I've done since the 1950s in this voluminous look at immigrants in the USA and all at that point. So America was founded, grew, and flourished in terms of ethnic peoples, population, religious adherents, and their churches. We'll explore these categories, obviously in a condensed format. Herberg described America following 1607, saying, the colonists that came to these shores from the time of the founding of Jamestown, 1607, and this is the anniversary in the U.S. and for sure in Virginia of the founding of Jamestown, and it'll go on up into the summer of this year in celebrations, to the outbreak of the Revolution were mostly of English and Scottish stock, augmented by a considerable number of settlers of Dutch, Swedish, German, and Irish origin. Contrary to many assumptions, Catholicism did not come in significant numbers until the late 1800s. Herberg and Hanlon said in separate research documents in the 50s, at the time of the Revolution, this British Protestant element, usually though inaccurately known as Anglo-Saxon, constituted at least 75% of the 3 million whites who made up the new nation in 1775. And so that's the base statement. From this point in 3 million until 1924, 35 million legal immigrants entered the USA and became Americans. We're going to talk about how did they get shaped to become Anglos, a people group, which inaccurately described as white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. That is not, it's term used in a lot of social research, but it is not truly accurate. In addition, there were about 750,000 Negroes that were there at the time. I have the full breakdown on where they came from and where they went. And that's interesting too. The great influx of ethnics came in the next century, the 1800s. In three huge waves, stretching over something more than 100 years, over 35 million men and women left Europe to come to the continental United States. By 1924, when the Great Migrations were passed, the British Protestant element had been reduced to less than half the population. That was due to the immigrant of Catholics and others. And Americans had become linguistically and ethnically the most diverse people on earth, Herberg and Hanlon. That situation has continued to increase since 1924 to 2006, but there are some things we need to say about that before we can jump to 2006. The melding force from 1775 was a combination of these, and this is critical. America was a melting pot, and France's gift to us of the lady attributed to a real historical event that occurred in America. From 1775 was a combination of the reality of the frontier. Economics in America in that period, mainly due to the frontier. And the continuing waves of ethnic immigrants' arrivals from 1775-24, which had a direct thing to do with the frontier. Immigrants found plenty of opportunities to work on the western moving frontier and came in waves seeking frontier jobs. Oscar Hanlon writes his historical novel on the uprooted from Europe to the U.S. He writes some of the most touching and moving, accurate historical studies of how peasants in Europe were being more and more peasants with every generation as they had children, and the feudal lords gave them no more land, and the economy began to fall, and these people lived on less and starved on less and died on less until they decided when a letter came, I'm going to America to join my relatives, and they left Europe and came to America. The waves began to come. They had nothing left. Letters would come and say to them, come to America, my brother, my sister, my mother, my dad, my nephew, my neighbor, my friend, my schoolmate. Come to America. If you get a piece of land, they'll give it to you. If you cross the Shenandoah, if you cross the West Virginia mountains, if you go on the Kentucky frontier, the Ohio frontier, if you go to Missouri, they'll give you land. It's free, homesteaded. You can vote. You can be a citizen. You've got a voice. You can be somebody. Leave home and come here now. Letters went by the thousands and the waves came. And they came to go to the frontier to find a life they never had in Europe. First-generation immigrants rolled from menial jobs to middle-class manager business tasks. Now, we're summarizing a whole lot in this truncated edition. What happened when this first wave of immigrants got out into what is the western part of the state of Virginia, and then into what is now West Virginia, and down into Tennessee, and then through Pennsylvania, and moved west to Ohio and Indiana and all, and then on across to Kentucky, Tennessee, and Missouri and Oklahoma. As they moved, they worked in menial jobs, and then they wrote letters back. Now, they were serious about their family and friends coming and enjoying what they enjoyed, but they had another motive. They knew if their family came and joined them on the frontier, the business that they were now working in and starting, they could quit doing the menial jobs and move up to be middle-class managers. And the family that they were bringing would now do the menial jobs, and they would be the boss, and the others would be the workers, but they moved up, and this began what exists of the lower, middle, and upper-class sociological strata in America. And now middle class was being formed based on how many of these got in business and how many family came and produced this hierarchy of jobs on the frontier. And so now the frontier became fertile ground for more and more people to come. Y'all come. Come on. There's room. And there's room in my company for you to be my worker, though that wasn't in the letter. They realized it when they got there. And for the most part, many were happy because it was better than what they had had before. From 1830 to 1930, Irish, Bohemians, Slovaks, Hungarians, and many other peoples followed each other in the service of the pick and shovel. Each other earlier group displaced by newcomers moving upward in the occupational and social scale. If successive waves of immigration served as the push in this pattern of occupational advancement, education and acculturation to American ways provided the immigrants with the opportunity of making the most of it. Herberg, Protestant, Catholic, and Jew, quote, and documentation. We are a nation of Pantata ethne, as the Great Commission explains itself, and its 2,000 references in the Old and New Testament help us understand the meaning of Pantata ethne. The second generation of immigrants assumed the jobs that vacated the first generation immigrants who moved up the job ladder. As the frontier moved further westward and as new waves of immigrants came to America, the movement from menial to management jobs continued. And all of a sudden now the menial workers under their friends that invited them there, they say, aha! If I can recruit some family to come, I can now create another level of management, and these managers can move up to move on the frontier and start the same business out there. I'll manage the business here, and these friends of mine will come and work for me. And now the American economic expansion began to occur on a frontier that was as open to opportunity as people were there to make it happen. And this began to shape America. It shaped our economy. It shaped our society, it shaped our culture, and it shaped church, as we will see. This kept immigrants from wholesale settlement within ethnic enclaves, except in cities. There were a few. What happened, if there had been no frontier, it would have been the bulking up of ethnics in megacities. But because the frontier was there, they didn't bulk up. Small enclaves did. You can find them in New York. You can find some in Louisville. You can find them in Chicago. You can find them in Philadelphia, in Boston. You can find them on the seaboard cities. But they were small then. The bulk of these people went west because their life in the American cities on the east was not good economically. They had no chance, at least at the time. They did over time, but it still wasn't like the frontier, to move up to management and to ownership. They saw themselves as being menial like they were in Europe. So the bulk of the ethnics went to the frontier. And so this is what happened. Well, the next step in this. The Americanization process did produce in the somewhat melded population a fairly common English language among the ethnics. In those years, from 1780 until 1960s and 70s, they learned English because on the frontier, English was the only language. They weren't in their enclaves. They were on a moving frontier. They didn't join an ethnic community there. Few exceptions, Chinese and those from India, who were brought mainly to build the railroad. They did live in communities, and there's a little about that, but we'll not talk much about this in this condensed time together. But what happened was the bulk of the immigrants went on to the frontier. They learned English out of self-defense. It wasn't by choice, and many never lost their language, which was a home language that they used. In fact, Swedish Baptists did not change their preaching in Swedish Baptist churches in the U.S. until 1980. They didn't change the name from Swedish Baptist to Baptist General Conference until the late 70s and 1980. And even today, if you go up where Baptist General Conference are strong in Minneapolis and others, and even out in the West Coast, you'll still find some early service or even second service preaching in Swedish. And so some of this still maintained itself. Higher pronounced, pun intended, regional and some sub-regional dialectical accents, worldview expressions and word choices remain unmixed within the various ethnics. Some immigrants stayed in cities and often duplicated their ethnic status there. Americanization of the various European ethnics. Even though they learned English for a common economic reason, this language melding did not erase all their ethnic identities. As will be seen, this language melding did not erase their religious identity from the old country. Of all their ethnic qualities, their religious identity came over from the old country. They gave up their language as the main language, to where it was a home language, to learn English for business and taking care of why they came, to have land, recognition, vote, presence, and all. Their culture changed. They began to dress like in the West. There were some letters going back and forth, and they had a drawing of one of these back in the early 1800s, and they said, "What is this dress you've got on? What are all these big lettery things on your legs?" And he said, "I can't dress like I used to. I want my legs back, and so I put these leather chaps on because the clothes I had in Europe, the cactus tore my legs up." And so dress changed in parts of America to suit the work environment, which changed their dress to an American-style dress. Those in the steel mills, those elsewhere, had to wear a certain dress to survive and to keep the dangers of the job away from them. And so their cultural dress did not become a work dress. And all of these things began through a melding process. So the language, the dress, the culture had to take a back seat to a dominant Anglo culture that was developing at home. It was their home culture, and that persisted. However, the one thing that they didn't give up, religion. But the majority of them, as we shall see in a moment, had little to no religion. Most of the regional dialectical and worldview difference can be traced to ethnic heritage that persisted. Consider the Cajun Louisiana German dairy community spotted the nation. For other examples, see the DVD package entitled The Appalachians and the San Antonio, Texas Catholic Missions video produced by the U.S. Parks. I'd recommend you see those two videos if you can. If you have trouble, let me know. American frontier history shaped and melded only to a degree the European Thai ethnic peoples. Over a 200-year period, these multiple ethnic groups were melded mainly into an Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-Saxon-oriented population, at least in terms of language. It is out of this process that the WASP arose, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, which still is not an accurate identification of Anglo. American religious denominations, beginning in 1775 and continuing in 1950, underwent classic changes, which were only minimally theological. In American religious landscape, Protestantism dominated from the 1700s to 1900s. American Indians, who were almost the only Americans in the 1500s and 1600s, and who existed in many ethnic groupings, are said by various historians to have suffered the most between 1775 and 1924. As the European ethnics came and settled the American frontier from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The first change was the overrunning of the American Indians by the American immigrants. Of an estimated 300 plus original languages spoken within the American continent, 175 living languages remain. National Museum of the American Indian, the Smithsonian Institute, did the research for me. Optimum estimates of pre-Columbian population was 15 million. And J.D., this is why I'm glad you're taking in your paper all of those going south in that greater America. Optimum estimates, pre-Columbian population was 15 million to 18 million. R. David Edmonds of the UT Dallas, one of the most respected researchers in this field today. By 1860 in the continental USA, there were critical government, official government counts or estimates of 339,421 American Indians, James Collins, Native Americans in the census 1860 to 1890. Do you see the difference in that number? Of course, one was pre-Columbian. The other was just American continental area. What was the issue? American custom and even law was that if you went on an American frontier in the westward movement and any American Indian opposed you or threatened you at any point, you had a legitimate right to shoot them and kill them. And Lord, we'll have some things to answer for when the judgment comes. Praise the Lord, in the free state of Franklin in Tennessee, Baptists were the first to recognize American ownership of their land and bought that land from the American Indians and produced a constitution there that honored the Indians as the former owners, and they'd bought it from them. George Washington came down and celebrated that Baptist community that came over from North Carolina and Sandy Creek to that part of Tennessee. But this is a history that is not good. By the 1880, the American Indian count was 305,543, and the Trail of Tears and all of that continued to reduce it. Like all early U.S. census data, this was based upon a projected sample. The issue is declined from 15 million to 306,000 in certain parts. The epic story of the great migrations that made the American people come to an end substantially with World War I and with the restrictive legislation of the 1920s. 35 million, and here the peoples, we're not going to go into these details, but it's in there. Now we're going to look at the religious situation from 1775 to 1950. The first period. There was a status of Christianity in 1775 and the changes within the population in light of Christianity during this period. It was clear that the main reason that people migrated to the New World was primarily for religious freedom, political correctness notwithstanding. There were other minor reasons. The percent of Christians in the colonies, actual listed church members on the rolls like you were looking at in doing the math, and why I wanted to do that, for it's similar to this, about 12%, the majority were Protestants. The Bill of Rights and Western Frontier resulted in a marked change in religion in America. Congregational in 1780 listed itself as having 745 churches, and they had good records. Anglican Episcopal listed as having 405 churches. Presbyterian listed as having 490 churches. Y'all come right in, find a chair at some of these tables. Sad to say that the front, like in Baptist life, is still open. Lutheran, 235 churches. Methodist, less than 200 churches. Baptist, about 200 churches, about 190, 195. Of course, there were some out in the rural areas nobody ever knew anything about due to persecution. Same situation holds today in certain parts of the world. Catholics are not included because their numbers had not accumulated, nor their representation other than in Maryland and a couple of other places was there to study. Now let's go to 1850. Methodists were number one. Baptists had become number two. Presbyterian, three. Lutheran, four. Congregational, five. Episcopal, six. See Neil Braun's Laity Master's Thesis for more discussion of this dynamic with U.S. history, and he's got some graphics in there. And then he quotes the usual historians that give us the base data, but you'll have some graphics in his Master's Thesis study. By 1950, Baptist first. Methodist second, Lutheran third, Presbyterian fourth, Episcopal fifth, Congregational was last. You notice anything about this? In fact, the seven in 1775 were exactly reversed. I mean exactly reversed. There wasn't any one in a different position other than reversed. Now, why did this happen? What caused the reversal? What caused this to happen? By 1850, Methodists were the largest Protestant denomination in the USA, and Baptists were second. By 1950, Southern Baptists were the largest of the seven, and Methodists were second. It is very informative from a historic evangelization and missiological perspective to follow and compare the growth dynamics among these seven. Here it's very carefully summarized, and I'm going to drop quickly to look at two. Baptists in 1775, who had not yet divided into two major Baptist groups, which came at the time of the Civil War, Northern and Southern, were the smallest of the seven Protestant denominations. Methodists were next to last. What happened that caused this to turn around directly opposite? Congregationalists, whose polity was thought to be the best fitted for the frontier, went through an old lights and new lights theological controversy, followed by a comity agreement with Presbyterians, say book platform. Neither of them recovered from that missiological mistakes. I went from Boston West looking at congregational, what we would call associational or convention minutes. 90% was filled with an old lights, new lights controversy for all of those years. While the frontier was being won and the battles spiritually were fought there, the congregationalist was in a huge theological controversy that rendered them neutral and unable to carry the frontier. Yet it was Congregationalists who brought the initial and major political and religious group with a manifesto to the new land. And in 1900, Congregationalists had 1,000 missionaries on foreign fields, only to see them dwindle during the 1900s to a handful today. Anglican churches were identified with English colonizers with the cause of the Revolution and never overcame that image until they changed their name, obviously, to Episcopal. Few realize that many of the Puritans in what today are low church Anglicans had gone with Wesley, forming the foundations of the Methodist Church in both England and the colonies. So we've got to be careful about saying, why did Anglican Episcopal diminish? Large numbers, mostly all low church Anglicans in America at the time, went with the Methodists. They saw themselves as Anglican, and so did Wesley. However, Asbury changed that matter, and the populace, when everybody began to call them Methodists, and the name stuck, and the denomination was. While these groups grow, Presbyterians suffered from the comity agreement between them and Congregationalists. We won't go into it. Read the Saybrook platform, read that history, that they agreed that if we get to a city or a place on the frontier and congregation there, Presbyterians will leapfrog and go to the next one, if there was a next one, or wait till there was a next one and go. And what happened, like what happened with the tanks in France during the war? Our logistics could not keep up with the tanks. They were further out there. They ran out of gas, and they couldn't get there. Presbyterians and Congregationalists couldn't service their church plants in the new cities on the frontier, and therefore they didn't catch up with each other, didn't have bridging between each other, and therefore they did not grow because of that relationship with those in the background of their growth. The institutional denominations lagged. And we took this. Boy, the Smithsonian helped me greatly through the years in this study. They were very, very cordial and generous in their research. Still are, and I go up from time to time. When you take, and what they did, they took a population center. In fact, some of the things you see in maps today that people use, they did way back in the 1960s and 70s to help me in my research as well. They took the map of the U.S. with cities on it and put a stream across representing the flow of the population, and they put stars where the center of the American population was in each 10-year period. And you could see the center of America moving as the Westford frontier moved. I then took these denominations, all of them, all six of them, and put where the center of their population was at each one of these periods. The institutional denominations, meaning those that required seminary to pastor and to be ordained, those that the denomination said, we'll put you here in this church, you were pastor in that parish, and we'll make that choice for you, which was not true of Methodism until close to 1900. Those denominations that had structure and had to have land and building and a seminary graduate to have a church never got within 200 miles of the frontier. Only until cities had the strength and size and literacy and the development economically to support one of these graduates did they ever get on the frontier. That is critical for this study. Lutherans seem to be the strange anomaly among the six denominations. What is the most famous and largest name of Lutheran? As a denomination. What is their large? They have a number of Lutheran denominations in the U.S. and Canada. What's the largest one? Missouri Synod. Why is it named Missouri Synod? The Lutherans came, got to the East Coast, and the city said, we don't want you here. We are not going to allow you to stay here. Therefore, they saw that they couldn't survive in New York, they couldn't survive in Virginia, they couldn't survive in the South, in North Carolina, they couldn't survive in Massachusetts, and therefore, what did they do? They leapfrogged all the way to the Mississippi River and said, we'll just leapfrog out there, and there's nobody out there to persecute us. And the Missouri Synod, the largest and most heavily concentrated even to this day, place of Lutheranism, runs from about the bottom of Missouri all the way up into Canada. That is the strength and the place. And they jumped all the way out there on the frontier because of persecution and not being welcomed on the East Coast. And that's how they got where they are. Methodists had a strategy, a carefully defined and carefully managed geographic circuit plan. that fitted the frontier. Now, Wesley developed this for England. England would have nothing of it. In fact, Whitfield had to trick Wesley into even thinking this way. Wesley would not preach anywhere but behind a pulpit. He just said, preaching is not preaching if it's not behind a pulpit. If you get out of an Anglican church, it's not preaching anymore. It's talking. You can only preach in an Anglican church so recognized, so duly, you know, awarded recognition with a trained pastor. And I preach in the pulpit, and that's preaching. And Whitfield, you are disparaging the Anglican name by preaching out there in the field, especially in the commons. And Whitfield tricked him, and the rest is history. Wesley loved preaching out there like Whitfield did. And so his plan didn't work in England. It did in America. When the rigors of the circuit riot in the early days as the church moved over the country are brought before the mind and imagination, the question is frequently asked. This is in the book, Endless Line of Splendor, Halford Luckock. You know Halford Luckock as a Methodist scholar. He's all the men of the Bible, all the women of the Bible, all the stories, parables of the Bible. He's written a number of these books that preachers love for illustrations and for quick outlines for Wednesday night and Sunday when they hadn't done their sermon preparation. Halford Luckock was asked to write the history of Methodism. He wrote it in the 50s. Get this book if you can get it. Go down to your library and get it and read it. Here's what the question was. How did they stand that frontier? The answer is they didn't. They died under it. Halford Luckock chose the verse, he that loses his life shall find it. Here's history. They died, most of them, before their careers was much more than begun. Of the 650 preachers who had joined the Methodist itinerancy by the open of the 19th century, about 500 had to relocate, a term that was used for those who were too worn out to travel further. Many of the rest had to take periods of recuperation. Others located not because of health, but by reason of lack of support and the desire to marry and establish a home. Methodism required every circuit rider, even though half of them could not read and write, to find somebody, oftentimes a wife or a child, who was going to school. They had to keep a diary. Even they didn't even get money that was supposed to be theirs, even if it was there. In most cases, it wasn't there. The churches didn't have it to give them. They didn't get any money or any help if they didn't turn in their diary. So Methodism has a plethora of diaries. I've seen them. I've read a lot of them, what you can read of that writing and writing out in a rainstorm or out in a rural area, and some of them with blood on them. Sorry. Of the 737 circuit riders of the conferences to die. That is, all who died up to 1847. 203 of them were between 25 and 35 years of age. How many of us are older than 35? 124 died between 36 and 45. Nearly half died before they were 30 years of age. Of 672 of those first preachers whose records we have in full, their entire itinerancy in diaries, two-thirds died before they had been able to render 12 years of service. Just one less than 200 died within the first 5 years. The Methodists covenanted in the 1700s, we're going to take the American frontier or die. And they did both. They took the American frontier by 1850 and they died doing it. It was a huge price, and praise God they paid it. Many circuits were from 300 to 600 miles in length. For instance, in 1791, Freeborn Garrettson was assigned to a circuit which included almost half of what is now the state of New York. Interesting, we still have only two associations in New York, and so our associational guys have to travel that much even today, 100 years later. In 1814, James B. Finley on the Cross Creek Circuit, Ohio, had a circuit covering more than two counties, preached 32 times on every one of his circuits, his one circuit every time. The salary schedule has an eloquence of its own. Cash was almost unknown. It was in kind. 1821, Benjamin T. Crouch, records receiving only 38 toward his year's allowance. The same year, Peter Cartwright received the highest salary in the Kentucky Conference, $238. But when he moved with his wife and six children to the Sangamon Circuit, Illinois, he received $40 all told for the year. Methodism grew faster until after 1850, but Baptist growth from 1800 to 1960 is unparalleled. From a little over 100,000 in 1800, they were approaching 20 million by 1960, Baptist, all Baptist. The basic reason is Baptist theology and polity fitted them better for the frontier than any other denomination of churches. Each local church was autonomous. They didn't have to get permission from anybody to be church or to do church. Churches were congregational in polity. Baptist church members going west were encouraged to plant a church if no Baptist church existed where they settled. I don't have time to tell stories. I'll tell only this one. I was down in South America doing some review of ethnic people group training for our folks in South America, about 230 of them in about three separate meetings a week at each, going over what is the Southern Baptist way of handling ethnic, ethno-linguistic people group church planning. In the process, I shared this. They asked me to share it on one morning, and I did. And a lady came up. She said, Jim, she was crying. She said, Jim, I'm glad you showed this. I came from Methodist stock. In fact, she said, I was Methodist until I met my husband to be in college and then married him. And so she said, now, hun, what happens if we go out somewhere in the U.S., in the northern part of the USA, and there's no Baptist church? What are you going to do? She said, well, I'll tell you what, I'm not joining any other church. I'm going to plant one. Now, this was the motto of Baptists when they left the East Coast. Sandy Creek and all of them said this to their members. When you cross the Shenandoah and when you cross those West Virginia mountains and when you get where you're going, Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio, Indiana, when you get where, if there's not a Baptist church, don't you join any other church and don't you not go to church, you plant one. You are given the official mandate from Baptists in the East. You plant the church if there is not one. And they often ask, and it's in Baptist minutes, what am I going to do about a pastor? He said, God called you as pastor until the congregation chooses another pastor. You start it and you pastor it. When the congregation decides they need a new pastor, they'll tell you that's Baptist and that's the way it'll operate and that's the way the frontier operated. Churches that emerged met in homes, saloons, hardware stores, barns, stables, schoolrooms, under trees. Oh, some funny, some sad stories about this history. Local churches found their pastor within the maturing believers in their emerging church. Local churches called, recognized, and ordained their own pastors. Experienced pastors tended to itinerate, passed in 2 to 4 of the churches. As frontier towns settled in and grew, some churches sought pastors from more settled frontier towns to the east, but it was well in the late 1800s before this began to happen. By the mid to late 1800s, in settled territory behind the frontier's leading edge, as churches there increased in number, in membership size and stability, with pastors of longer tenure in the pastorate, requests arose for training. They said, we're not equal to this growing church thing. We need training. This led to Baptist schools being started. And the history of our Baptist school, even this institution, came out of that scream, please train us. And that's why this institution is where it is, in the very heart of the frontier. When you take the frontier and look at those stars, this was the center of American population when Southern was founded. Sweet, Herberg, Latourette, Braun, and multiple other historians said that the most common growth factors were the starting of churches and homes, where land and building for a church was not a condition for having and being a church, and lay preachers and pastors, most of whom were bivocational. Over time, for sure, by the early 1900s, as religious status became the leading characteristic of an American, the Bible Belt was forming. The American culture was developing a stronger Christian ethic with Christian values at its base. The base was in practice for some and only in the awareness or conscious ought-to stage for others. It is out of this base that the terms lost, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, and Judeo-Christian emerged in the mid-1900s. Their big concern was the preservation of their way of life, above all, the planting of their churches. Now I'm going to summarize here. What time is it? My clock died.
Almost 10 after.
All right. We're going to stop. Have a break, come back, whole rest of the period is going to be the other. Let me summarize. Here's what happened. by 1960, Southern Baptist was the leading Protestant denomination in America. We had had that history of who we were. And America, from 1945 till 1965, experienced the golden age. It'll be in the screens there. You can look at all the details. You can look at all of the data related to growth and all there. But here's what happened. America came to a point to where culturally we owned the Judeo-Christian values. We owned them. They were so prominent from 1945 to 1965, and that's where Herberg got the title for his social history. If in a Protestant community you were not Protestant and did not go regularly to church, if you were Jewish in a Jewish community and you did not go to the synagogue regularly and was not known as a synagogue participant, if in a Catholic community you were not a Catholic worshiper, mass goer, if you ran for mayor, for state senator, state representative, for the U.S. Congress, you would never get elected without that heritage. Now, Herberg says, and so does Hanlon, both of them, you could study the lifestyle of these people and you could hardly imagine they were Christian. But the culture owned the Judeo-Christian ethic of being and having Christian values. And therefore, both of these sociologists said you had a dual lifestyle, a public avowed Christian lifestyle, or you did not meet the standards of being a leader and a person in American life. However, their personal lifestyle was debauched in many cases. And it was a period of the worst upheaval over segregation and race in our history. It was the golden age of Christianity. And there was nothing golden about that. Though there are arguments to the contrary, that we wouldn't have done what we did if we hadn't had that Christian base. It would have been worse than it was, and we won't go there right now. But here's what we know. In the USA, in this period of golden age of Christianity, is when the largest number of divinity departments were started in secular universities. If a secular, not religious university didn't have a divinity department, it was not seen by the Association of Colleges and Universities as, to use a Jewish term, kosher. It was not seen as having a full, replete category of departments, degrees, and all. And therefore, many major universities, with the exception of those in the Northeast, which most of which, Harvard and Yale and Princeton, were denominational schools before they became very, very secular in their cast and all, if not owned by secular trustees. And therefore, America owned a Judeo-Christian value system up front. It followed a Judeo-Christian value system in its practice of voting and choosing CEOs and leaders. To stand up and be an Ingersoll in the 50s, you'd get shouted down. They would never invite you back. To be an atheist in the 50s and 40s was an unheard of thing publicly. Privately, oh yes, clubs met in secret and things like that. It was the easiest era of evangelism. This is when your four spiritual laws was born. And it worked. You could develop a very simple, basic, assumed presentation on four spiritual laws that assumed a whole lot about values, and you could present it, people would understand, and people would follow. Southern Baptists could develop a program in Florida, in Carolina, in Texas, in Kentucky, and we could take it to Nashville and print it and teach it in our state conventions, and a very generic program would work throughout the Southern Baptist Convention. Primarily in the Bible Belt, because we were more homogeneous than we've ever been. Now, what's the bottom line? From 1960s, beginning with the Flower Child movement, with the postmodernism coming to America, with all of the debates that began to be had, even between some Southern Baptists and some of the folks in the postmodern movement in Atlanta and other places like that, began to have the debates, and America began to move into that generation of riots on campuses and others. And then the next wave began. From 1965 until 2000, more than 35 million more immigrants came to America, many of whom were not legal. There was no frontier. The economy was already on very set perimeters as to how the American economy works. There were very few opportunities for incoming immigrants to move up to own things, not the way it was on the frontier. And as a result, immigrants coming only in a minority gave up their heart language. Many, like on the frontier, learned another language, English, in order to do business, but many depending on one of their own to run the business, and they would be the menial laborers and all, and did not necessarily learn the English language that well. Now, only a minority of the ethnics coming to America are assimilating and becoming Anglo in habit, in culture, and in dress. The majority want their own culture, their own language, their own places and communities to live in. And that is what is happening in America. And the more you move to Hindus, the more you move to Muslims, and the more you move to other religions, this is exaggeratedly true. America is becoming a country of immigrants who choose to retain their ethnic identity and who choose to live and function in American life. And the only other political statement I'll make, this presidential election is going to be, that's going to be one of the major issues there. We're going to talk more about this in the fourth session as we'll take a break, a 10-minute break, and come back, and we're going to dialogue from that break time until the next time when we come back to look at drawing all of this together and talking about what are the implications for church planting in light of these things. So we'll see you in about 10 minutes and take the rest of this period for dialogue, conversation,